KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. California's earthquake risk is well documented. Less known is the significant risk that Salt Lake City, Boston, and New York City face, leaving those and other major cities across the United States underprepared for a major trembler. In Quakeland, on the road to America's next devastating earthquake, journalist Catherine Miles examines the myth that earthquakes are a West Coast phenomenon, and she discusses how Americans can step up their quake preparedness. And welcome, Catherine Miles. Good to have you with us.
Hi, very glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. And you come away from your book realizing that there's a kind of ubiquitousness about earthquakes, not only in terms of their being everywhere, but even maybe more shocking and more sobering is the fact that there are many fault lines we haven't even discovered. We don't even know.
And that was a real surprise for me as I was doing the research for this book is exactly what you said, is not only is this not only a West Coast problem, but also this is a problem that seismologists are only beginning to understand, and the real pervasiveness still remains something of a mystery.
There's also the pervasiveness of concern about metropolitan areas, big cities being hit, New York especially, but other cities throughout the United States and being hit hard. And in many ways, you come away from your book feeling, boy, we don't know what we're in for. And I was just reading, in fact, this morning in the Huffington Post, a whole lot of speculation about the rotation of the Earth and how that's making earthquake activity even greater in terms of likelihood.
Well, and that comes down to this idea of unknowability, right? And just the fact that this is such a nascent science in so many ways. When you think about it, you know, plate tectonics wasn't even really accepted as a bona fide theory until really the late 1960s, early 1970s. We still don't really understand what causes most earthquakes. When you factor in things like human activity, things like wastewater injection and drilling, we see that we can actually change the face of seismic hazard. And so there's all of this unknowability that really makes it beholden upon all of us to be prepared, since we just don't know when the next quake will happen.
Yeah, you bring a lot of that into your book. I mean, the unknowability of things like fracking. Oklahoma is a good example, isn't it?
It's a great example. Here's a state that just 10 years ago was one of the least seismically active in the entire United States, is currently the most seismically active in the lower 48. And again, you know, really pretty indisputable proof that human activity, the injection of wastewater that's a result of this drilling, this hydrofracking, is in fact causing the seismic activity. And not only that, but the earthquakes are getting bigger and bigger. And that raises concerns not just for the residents of Oklahoma, of course, but also for the world, frankly. You know, the largest holding of oil on the planet is located in a little town called Cushing, which is right at the heart of all this activity.
But we're learning more, even though as far as natural disasters go, we're probably more ignorant about earthquakes than we are about anything. We're learning more in the wake of earthquakes that are taking place. What did we learn specifically, for example, about preparedness from the Mexico City quake? Because they had an early warning system. They had also national drill program going on since 1985.
It's a great question, and you raise those exact two very key points. After that 1985 quake, the country did, as you say, institute a national drill program that takes place every year on the anniversary of that quake. And as luck and happenstance would have it, that was also the day of this most recent quake. So just hours before this 2017 quake, the entire country had been literally drilling about what to do in the case of a quake. And that's hugely important, knowing where to stand or knowing how to take cover, knowing what to do in the event of that you need to get out of a building can really be the difference between life and death. This early warning system is something I can't stress enough. Mexico was the first country to institute it. They've been followed by other countries, including Japan and the Philippines. And we as a nation have the technology in place to have this, thanks in large part to researchers in your neck of the woods. Folks at the University of Washington, folks at some of the UCAL programs as well, have devised this beta program that works with something as simple as a cell phone and can give you 45 seconds, a full minute, to take cover, to redirect planes, to grab someone who was really important to you, to grab your go bag, and to be in a place where you stand a much better chance of surviving the quake.
Talking with Catherine Miles, her book is Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake, and she actually did go on the road, and we'll talk about that with her as well. But there's also a necessity that comes across in reading your book of really doing retrofitting and doing mitigation, a lot of which has been done right here in the San Francisco Bay Area, of course, to lessen the risk in schools and hospitals and apartment buildings and so forth. But you're talking about places that just aren't often even associated in any way with earthquakes. Salt Lake City, Seattle, L.A., New York. Well, L.A., yes, but D.C., I mean, and talking about them in an inevitable kind of context.
And that's part of what's so tricky, right? This question of inevitable and this question of prediction. You know, as a country, we've tried really hard to predict earthquakes. We invested millions and millions of dollars, especially in the 1970s and the 1980s. And so far, we've been unsuccessful when it comes to prediction. The best we have right now is this notion of what's called a return rate, right? We can do this sort of investigative work, this kind of post-mortem work that looks at faults and says, well, you know, this fault or this area has had an earthquake, say, every 100 years in the case of a place like New York City. The last moderate quake in New York was in 1883. So based on return rates, we can say that New York is 40 years overdue for an earthquake. Does that mean that we'll have one tomorrow? No, but certainly the likelihood is there. When it comes to certainty, the best certainty we have is that there will be a quake in Southern California during our lifetimes. But that doesn't negate the fact that there are other places really at risk, as you mentioned. One that would be particularly crippling to the country is Memphis. And that's just not a place we talk about when we talk about seismic activity colloquially.
Well, we've been talking about an inevitable quake here in the Bay Area for many, many years, as long as I've been here. And I've been here since the 70s. But Loma Prieta, though it wasn't that quake on the San Andreas or on the Hayward Fault, as you point out in your book, was the first televised quake because we had the World Series and tens of millions of people saw what happened, and yet it didn't necessarily change or, shall we say, create any seismic change in the attitude toward earthquakes.
And that's really remarkable to me. You know, and it comes down to culture, I think. You know, as a country, we seem to suffer from a real lack of imagination and also a really poor memory when it comes to earthquakes. I remember that earthquake really well. I was living in the Midwest. I was in high school and about to go to marching band practice. And I remember seeing the same sort of shocking images that other people saw of, you know, pancaked highways and things like that. Did it necessarily change our public perception? No, I don't think it really did. And that's too bad because we know that it's coming again. And so the question is, you know, how bad will the devastation be? And that's where that planning and preparedness really comes in.
Well, the devastation, according to your lights, and you've done a lot of research on this, can be absolutely extraordinary beyond our imagination. I'm looking earlier in your book when you say, want to put in context, consider this, losses from 9/11, nation's deadliest and costliest terrorist attack, added up to $120 billion. That's a good chance our next quake will cost more. But we're not even talking about human life. That's just cost and expense.
Right. And it comes in surprising ways that people don't necessarily think about it. If you consider, for instance, that famous historic quake in San Francisco, you know, you have the obvious sort of immediate effects of the quake, the rubble, the buildings falling down. But one of the biggest expenses and one of the biggest killers when it comes to earthquakes isn't actually, you know, rubble. It's fire, right? And fire that's exacerbated by the fact that first responders can't get there to put it out. And so in some cases, like, for instance, in San Francisco in the last century, you see fires burning for days and days and days. And so that's the sort of long-range thinking we need to be doing, not just about whether or not our building is resilient enough to not collapse in an earthquake, but what are the after effects? What happens when our cell phones go down? What happens when we have no means of communicating either with people we love or with those first responders? Are we going to be prepared to survive in the meantime?
And you make the point that we really need to, in many respects, not only appreciate, but elevate the first responders and those emergency people who we're so dependent on in many ways. But American Society of Civil Engineers has a report card on the United States infrastructure. It's been going on now for a couple of decades. It's been a solid D across the board, right?
Yeah, and you know, this is a problem that goes back decades, you know, really to sort of post-World War II, where, you know, we as a country made decisions to invest in some things over than others, which of course is necessary. But one of the things that we have historically underinvested in for decades now is infrastructure, both literal infrastructure, things like our roads, our power grids, but also metaphoric infrastructure, things like weather forecasting, things like tsunami warning. These are all pieces of the puzzle that are really important. that we've kind of put on the back burner for way too long. And that's going to catch up with us really quickly, not just in terms of natural disasters, but also in terms of the resiliency and the productivity of the country as a whole. As I like to say, you know, investing in retrofitting a bridge isn't necessarily going to just help you in the case of an earthquake. It's also going to help traffic patterns. It's going to help the flow of commerce. And so we stand to benefit in all sorts of ways from that kind of investment.
And again, we're talking with Catherine Miles. She's the author of Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. And let me invite listeners to join us. I know there are many of you who have questions and concerns, obviously, about earthquakes and about some of the material that we've already mined here. But also, you might want to talk about how you're preparing for the next big one, because it will come, and what you've done or what you feel needs to be done. And this can be useful for all our listeners. Let's hear from you. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. And we do invite your calls, so feel free to join the program at our toll-free number. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also bring questions or comments to us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post your questions, comments, or anything that's on your mind there, kqed.org/forum. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You've been keeping up on what the government's doing? Are they investing in this more or to a greater extent? And what do you see on that horizon, Catherine Miles?
Well, you know, we saw most recently President Trump issued a 6-page white paper on his infrastructure plan. It didn't have any details on it. Congress then undertook it and is still trying, you know, to negotiate a budget that's useful. And right now, unfortunately, we're in this sort of, you know, fiscal cliff situation where a lot of the organizations, like, for instance, the Army Corps of Engineers, who do this sort of work, are kind of at a standstill right now because they haven't been assured the funding for the next fiscal year that they're going to need.
Also, when we're talking about funding, and a lot of funding is needed here, not only for research but for infrastructure, you've been saying, but one of the things you point out in your book that I think is important is the result that earthquakes happen so quickly, and there's often PTSD, there's often a depression and anxiety that follows. There are a lot of mental health issues that go with the devastation from earthquake, just as we're seeing now with the fires that have taken place to the north here in Santa Rosa and Sonoma County and Napa.
This is a fascinating new subfield of psychology that's emerging, and that is the psychological effects of natural disasters. And what we know from research is not only are all natural disasters incredibly arresting and affecting things, but there's something about the nature of an earthquake that is particularly damaging. And some psychologists speculate that it's twofold. It's both that we've so internalized this idea that the ground beneath our feet is solid and isn't going to move. And when you think about the metaphors we use, you know, it's always on this idea of, you know, bedrock and foundation, and it's there and it's dependable. And then there's also the unknowability, right? If you think about a hurricane or even a tornado, there's some advanced warning that it's coming. Whereas with an earthquake, and without that early warning system, the only notification we have is the shaking itself. You couple that with the actual physiological effects of the inner ear, which can sometimes sort of take a long time to adjust to the end of shaking. It's a similar phenomenon than what happens if you step off a boat that's been in waves, you know, you still feel like you're at sea. So this combination of things does seem to be particularly damaging. And when we look at places like Fukushima, we look at places like Italy, we see a really, really sort of collective damage that can take a long time to undo.
You say in your book that over 75 million Americans currently live in areas of significant risk, and the number is expected to rise. Why?
Well, two reasons. First of all, every year, we're discovering new faults. As you mentioned earlier, there are approximately 2,100 known faults in the United States. The folks at the USGS, who are primarily responsible for mapping these faults, say that there are exponentially more faults that we don't know about. Every major earthquake in recent history has occurred on a fault that we didn't know was there prior to when the earthquake happened. So it can sometimes take an actual seismic event for us to know there. For obvious reasons, a lot of our research has been looking west of the Mississippi, places like California. Again, when you look at the San Andreas Fault Zone, hundreds of faults existing there, and for good reason. We spent a lot of time looking at those. We haven't necessarily spent the same amount of time in a place like New York City, which, as it turns out, is absolutely crisscrossed by faults, some of which capable of creating those moderate earthquakes I talked about earlier, and then the Ramapo Fault Zone just outside New York City, which some people think is capable of a 7.0 or maybe even a stronger earthquake.
Well, in fact, there was a major fault discovered in Virginia, right, that Biggest earthquake there since east of Mississippi since 1897. And also, you write about Plainfield, Connecticut, where no one knows why there were like hundreds of faults that they didn't know about, right?
Well, hundreds of earthquakes.
And hundreds of earthquakes.
Right. And the best guess among state geologists there is that this quarrying activity that has gone on there for a while allowed water during sort of an unusual thaw-freeze cycle in a winter. It allowed water to get deep kind of into the bedrock and kind of expand and contract and cause quakes there. And that's another one of those examples of this possible induced seismicity that is making otherwise non-seismically active areas suddenly seismically active. We're seeing that in Ohio. We're seeing it in Arkansas. We're seeing it in places like Saskatchewan. And so it is very much sort of changing seismic hazard and risk such that the USGS now, for the first time in its history, issues hazard maps that include induced seismicity.
Yeah, I want to get to our callers, but you mentioned some of the things that are being discovered, and you do write about the New Madrid Fault. And Robert writes, several million people in the Mississippi Valley live in the New Madrid seismic zone. When the 7.5 earthquake hit there in 1811, the devastation was limited due to the tiny population. Now the entire region is carpeted almost exclusively with single and multi-story unreinforced brick waiting to collapse in a giant cloud. Unfortunately, I think he's correct, 100% correct.
Well, yeah. He raises a great point. And again, you know, a really important thing to keep in mind here is yes, that will be absolutely devastating to the residents there. But if you think it's not going to be devastating to you, that's being really short-sighted. You know, something like 4 million packages a night travel through the Memphis airport because both UPS and FedEx have hubs there. 40% of our commerce travels a single bridge that crosses there in terms of our trucking commerce. And so the overall effects of in terms of our national sort of economy is really at risk were something to happen like that in Memphis again.
One more quick question, and then I'll go to listener calls. Jim wants to know, since we all pay for government-subsidized flood insurance, where is our government-subsidized earthquake insurance?
It's a great question. It's a really great question. And to what degree should people individually be investing in it? And to what degree should we collectively? I was amazed at the number of seismologists and geologists that I interviewed for this book who don't have earthquake insurance. And that's not necessarily a good sell for why we should all have it as well.
But the people you talk to are real heroes. I mean, they come across as real heroes. These, as I said, emergency managers who are trying to keep us safe and the scientists who are doing the first responders and so forth. There's a good deal of tribute in your book to them and deservedly so. Let me bring our callers in and let me go first to you. Anna, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. So I am in Sunnyvale, California, and I just want to put in a plug for the CERT program, Community Emergency Response Team. It is a nationwide FEMA program that trains people to do disaster response so that we can help our neighbors after a disaster. And it's a free program. It's nationwide. Look it up in your area and get involved.
We've done programs on the CERT programs here in the Bay Area and elsewhere. Catherine Miles, you want to comment on them?
Yeah, I can't second that enough. And to say also, there's a similar program that's building resilient communities. And this idea that, again, you know, it's not enough just to sort of weather the natural disaster, but in fact to make sure that we're resilient and we're going to come back really strong. And this idea of community is so important. You know, when you think about it, you can do all that you want to sort of retrofit your own home, but if your neighbor hasn't also done the same, you know, your work could be for naught. So this idea of really understanding that it is a community project and that we can not just help one another kind of be prepared for the quake, but also come back in a way that feels really strong and holistic is so important.
And here's another caller. Afsane, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My question is basically regarding to the recent huge earthquake in Iran, border of Iran and Iraq, that it killed thousands and thousands of people, and we all devastated in the result of that. I want to know what you think of how is it possible that this huge area was affected by earthquake? Because of the political situation over there, people are thinking that maybe there was some kind of a activity that people don't know. Maybe it wasn't really natural. I want to know what you think of that recent earthquake in Iraq.
Well, Catherine Miles' book is Quakeland, and Quakeland is the United States. But some thoughts on the recent huge tremor over there?
Absolutely, sure. And, you know, I haven't seen any evidence that this was anything other than a natural quake, and certainly there's the sort of seismic potential there. But this idea of how many people affected and why it can affect such a large area is a worldwide question, and it comes down to multiple things, like the type of soil and rock beneath us. Shifting it back to the U.S. just real quickly, for instance, you know, the same sized earthquake that happens in California is going to feel like a stronger earthquake on the East Coast because of the nature of the bedrock, because of the nature of the ground, everything in terms of its density and also, frankly, its temperature. There was another earthquake over there a few decades ago where 30,000 people died. So, and it was actually not as strong of an earthquake as this one last week. So why? Well, part of it has to do with buildings, right? The first earthquake happened in a place where there were a lot of indigenous structures. Those did not fare nearly as well as, for instance, the more contemporary steel and glass. We saw that in Mexico as well, too, in Chile. In Chile, it was actually the opposite. You know, two earthquakes of similar size, one had an infinitely higher mortality rate, and that had to do with the fact that actually in their case, the indigenous structures did much better than contemporary ones. So it raises an important point that it's not just the strength of the earthquake, but it's other factors as well, including, you know, ground, including the structures that are built upon it.
Catherine Miles is with us, a journalist and the author of a new book called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. And here's John, who writes, I asked for suggestions about what you're doing for earthquake preparedness. John writes, cash will be king after an earthquake. A kit is a great idea, but keep at least $2,000 stashed somewhere accessible. ATMs will fail. Credit cards will not work. And here's Jeffrey from Point Reyes Station. Jeffrey, you're on.
Hi. This is a great program. I live in Point Reyes Station, right near Olema, and I know we're on the San Andreas, right on the San Andreas Fault. I live in a single-story wooden structure in a horse ranch, in the park, Point Reyes National Seashore. And I was just wondering, what kind of supplies? What would be most important to have on hand in case of a big quake?
Catherine Miles.
Such a great question. And every time someone asks that question, dozens of emergency managers raise up their hands and cheer. So thank you for asking it. You know, I can't stress enough the importance that we should all have a go bag. And in that go bag, which could be a duffel bag, a backpack, something that you can literally grab if you need, the general recommendation is that we should have a week's worth of food, a week's worth of water, a week's worth of clothing for a variety of temperatures, particularly cold temperatures, as well as first aid. What we know is that in some of these areas, for instance, Cascadia, places, as you mentioned, around the San Andreas Fault Zone, it could well be the case that it takes a week for first responders to get to us. When you think about, for instance, what we're seeing in Puerto Rico, here we are 2 months out from Maria, right? And we're still seeing people without clean drinking water. We're still seeing people without electricity. That was a hurricane, of course, but the devastation and the lingering effects can be exactly the same for an earthquake.
And you can find a link with a list of what to have in a go bag at our website, kqed.org/forum. You may want to mark that down. And again, we're talking to Catherine Miles. Her new book is Quakeland. Richard writes, Catherine Miles, contrary to your guest's comment about no early warning for earthquakes, what about P waves?
Well, right. And that's how the early warning system works, right? There's two waves, a P wave and an S wave.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit more what P waves are.
Sure. So there are these two different waves, and because they move at two different speeds, this is how early warning systems work. So that P wave starts, it moves out at a faster speed than the S wave. And so what we can do by way of computer modeling is seismologists grab that first P wave as it's coming, it registers as an earthquake, and then, you know, it grabs that S wave as it's coming and as it moves across, and we see that ever-widening window between the two of them. If you think back to like high school algebra, you know, two trains leave a station, one's traveling 40 miles an hour, the other's traveling 35 miles an hour. We can triangulate not only where the epicenter and the hypocenter of the earthquake is, we can also triangulate how strong it is, and we can predict by way of this modeling sort of when it will get to you. So that's how it works. And yes, absolutely, we have the technology working. If you look at places like, for instance, San Francisco, BART is usually a beta modeling of this to kind of test it out. Folks at UC Davis as well as UC Berkeley have a beta program that they're trying out there as well, too, and they've had excellent results with it working and working accurately. What we don't have right now is the congressional funding to make it a national program.
Let me bring some more callers on. But before I do, I want to get back to what we're doing that maybe we shouldn't be doing in terms of heightening the likelihood or the possibility of earthquakes, since there are so many faults that haven't even been discovered. And since seismic science is still pretty much a kind of quasi-primitive science, we're in the dark ages in many ways. But I'm just wondering, all this oil extraction, dams, reservoirs, wastewater injection, building high-rises, I mean, it all just exacerbates, doesn't it?
It does. And this was a real surprise for me going into this book. I had no idea how many ways human activity can cause seismic activity, if that makes any sense. You know, and it comes from really surprising places. When we were filling Lake Mead, the reservoir behind the Hoover Dam, that action of filling the reservoir created 10,000 earthquakes. Now, admittedly, these were not huge quakes, right? The building of a high-rise in Taipei set off hundreds of earthquakes. We talked about the work earlier in places like Connecticut. So right now, this induced seismicity is, in general, fairly low to moderate level seismicity, though there are some exceptions in places like India. But what we're also finding out through research is that small earthquakes can sometimes create and beget large earthquakes. We don't know which small ones will create the big ones, but this is a real concern in places like Oklahoma, is that this moderate earthquake activity is ultimately possibly weakening or in some cases adding extra strain to these larger fault zones that are capable of truly devastating quakes.
Let me get David on. David, you're on.
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on the air, sir.
I would say the big barrier to seismic retrofit is political and money. I'll give you two examples. In 14 at the 20-year anniversary conference for Northridge, the mayor of Salinas, which is in harm's way, said, well, the big box stores on the perimeter of the city, outside the city limits, if they mandate brick and mortar.
David, I'm sorry. your line is pretty bad, and we're getting short on time here. Let me go to the cut to the chase here. Catherine Myers, political barriers to getting more funding. I mean, I think he's raising an important question here. Let's hear what you have to say on that.
Absolutely. You know, and there's obviously an understandable cost-benefit analysis that every community has to undertake. If you live in Iowa, for instance, you may decide that requiring retrofitting is not a good use of your community dollars or your individual dollars. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of sort of political infighting in Washington right now relating to budgetary allotments at the federal level. So yeah, but my hope is that we can all agree that this is money worth spending.
One final comment from Tiana says, I find going on at least one camping trip a year keeps my emergency gear working. If an earthquake ruins the grid, the ability to cook independently is valuable. Why don't people talk about this kind of preparedness with some built-in fun component? Good note to end on, but a serious book. And the book, again, is Catherine Miles' Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Catherine Miles, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a real pleasure.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue discussion online, kqed.org/forum. Tomorrow on this hour, Alzheimer's.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.